This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Lest we forget, Malaysia is also a party to the Child Convention. Under the Child Convention, or Conventions on the Right of the Child, Article 22 in particular says that every state members must give protection to refugee children and asylum-seeking children. In Malaysia, we have ratified the convention and we withdrawn our reservation in relation to Article 22 of the Child Convention. So as far as the international community is concerned, Malaysia has made a declaration, an announcement that they will look into the plights of refugee children. They will give protection to refugee children. They will give assistance to refugee children. But in reality, again, I mean, this is where we do not see any concrete action or measures being taken by the government. It's high time for the government to walk the talk.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. The Freedom Film Fest has been bringing socially relevant human rights films to Malaysians since 2003, and now as we're all staying home to stay safe, the folks behind the Freedom Film Network are releasing a specially curated playlist every Friday, which they've dubbed Weekend Watch with Freedom Film Festival, and this is happening on their YouTube channel, giving us lots to watch and also lots to think about as well. So this weekend's playlist is centered around the theme of refugees, as it's World Refugee Day this Sunday. And joining me now is Hari Azizan. She's the director of a film called The Invisible Children, which takes a look at the access to education, or lack thereof, for refugee children here in Malaysia. And we're going to find out more about her film. Welcome, Hari. How are you today?
Hi, good. How are you, Juliet?
I'm good. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. So, Hari, you know, this is a film that you made back in 2006. You know, it's been a long time, but take me back to then. You know, why did you want to tell a story about refugees in Malaysia and you know, with a focus particularly on the kids?
Okay, so at that time, I was volunteering with Amnesty International, and we were doing a lot of human rights campaigning. And at that time, they were very strict. So you're not allowed to work on home issues. So I was volunteering on the Aceh human rights issue, as well as Myanmar, the Myanmar campaign. And at that time, we were only looking at the human rights perspective. So I wasn't really aware about the refugees living in Malaysia. And then my friend told me about her friend who was working with the Rohingya community, about how, I think she was a volunteer teacher, you know, about the problems that we were facing getting an education. And that got me interested in looking at it more.
Okay. As we know that, you know, Malaysia, we're not a signatory to the UN Refugee Convention, right?
And yes, we are not.
Yeah, so that means there's no legal framework for refugees. It leaves them very vulnerable as undocumented migrants, right? So you focused on the children, and I watched the documentary, and you spoke to several different communities of refugees and how their status as a refugee impacts their day-to-day life in Malaysia, right? Tell me about that. You know, who did you speak to?
So the main protagonist is a Chin boy called Moses. So to be honest, I can't remember how I got in touch with him because I just kind of cast my net wide to get contacts. So I was introduced to him, and then he told me about how he really wanted to go to school. And of course, his dream is of getting resettled in the US. And, you know, he felt like he did very well when he was in Myanmar. And now, you know, he can't go to school. And so his education was interrupted. So he was very frustrated about that because he said, you know, if he goes to the US, he will have trouble catching up. And I think he wanted to be a doctor. That's one child. So then the other one, because my friend told me about her friend who was volunteering in the Rohingya community in Nampang as a teacher. And I think at that time, we were just getting to know about the Rohingya, although they have been here for a while, you know, about the Rohingya refugees in Malaysia. So I was very interested in that, trying to find out more about the community. So through NGOs, I went to a school in Selayang. I couldn't go to the school in Nampang, but I met a family in Nampang.
Okay.
Yeah. And then because of my experience working on the Aceh human rights issue, I was also interested in the Aceh community. And I met a girl also in Selayang. And at that time, they were also talking about they're not exactly refugees, but they are undocumented children in Sabah. Also about their problem in getting education. I think it was, because it was also a learning process for me, it was kind of wide-ranging, you know?
Was that your first effort at directing a short film, directing a documentary?
Yes, it was.
Okay. I mean, I found it interesting because I think what you try, you know, as a viewer, what I thought you were trying to do was to show that refugees are not a homogenous group. Everybody has similar situations, but also very different circumstances surrounding their day-to-day lives and what they are going through as well, right? I don't know. Was that something that you were trying to show in the film?
It was, in a way. And also, because I'm a journalist, I was also trying to give a wide perspective of the issue. So that's why I tried to cover as many communities as I can. And talking about the like personal experience, because as I say, I came in from the kind of the human rights framework, right?
Yeah.
So I thought it was very important to show the like kind of day-to-day experiences, like, you know, the personal experience behind this. And also, I talked about this a lot last time. It also reminded me of when I was in university. So I had two friends. So one is a Tibetan refugee. She was born in Dharamsala, India. So, you know, she really didn't know her homeland. Mm. But there's always like a deep longing and a hole in her, especially, you know, for that land that she, that home that she never knew about. Just from stories from her family and, you know, the from the community. And at the risk of dating myself, I also met a Bosnian refugee. She was 18 when the war broke out. She went over to the UK and she was supposed to go to university that year. So she was just very angry and very frustrated that, you know, she couldn't do, she couldn't continue her education. She couldn't reach her dream. And it's just when my friend, the one in Malaysia, you know, like told me about the children and the refugee children and their problems in getting education, you know, then it reminded me of these two friends, I mean, their experience living as a refugee. So like my Tibetan friend, she was in a way lucky because she managed to go to school and, you know, then she was in university. Mm. But her experience as a refugee is like so deeply entrenched in her that, you know, kind of affected her outlook in life and was very much a part of her. And with my Bosnian friend, there was just a lot of anger and so, you know, so I started wondering about how the children here, you know, feel like not being able to go to school, you know, not being able to do what other kids are doing. Yeah. And basically feeling like they have no future.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
We know that, you know, for all of us, it's like, just get a basic education and, you know, you'll be sorted. Somehow you'll be sorted, right? But we are deliberately denying access to them, even though we are a party to, you know, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. But still, we don't allow them to access school in a formal way. So there's only like informal centres and things like that, you know, for refugee children, right?
Yeah. And we tried to go around to interview schools, teachers. So there's actually, it won't cost us much. You know, there is space. They can allow it. But as in everything to do with migrants and refugees in Malaysia, there's always this fear that it will open the floodgates. You know, like, oh, if we allow them to go to school, if we allow them to work, then it will just encourage more to come over. So I've noticed one quite shocking statistic. So when I did the documentary, there were about 9,000 refugee children in Malaysia. Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't know how true. I mean, I can't fact check that now.
Sure.
But the latest numbers from UNHCR is there are about 45,980 children in Malaysia.
Wow.
So, you know, I think in Malaysia, we like to close our eyes to what's happening, just sweep it under the carpet.
Yeah.
And we're clearly not dealing with the problem. And it's growing. So if you have 45,000 over children not getting education, a very small number will get resettled. So what's going to happen to them?
Yeah.
You know, we cannot ignore them.
And we do try to.
Yeah. So over the years, right, since I did the film, UNHCR has worked more with, I mean, they've got partners, partner NGOs, and more with the community. So there are more informal schools community-based schools. So there is an effort to give them education, but, you know, that's not enough. And the thing is, it will only help them in resettlement. So, you know, like for Malaysians who are scared of giving too much, actually, we are just trying to help them to go to the next level. Because, as you know, Malaysia is just a transit country for refugees. And the least we can do is to give them some basic education, give them literacy so that it will help them when they get resettled in their new home country. Yeah, so they can mix in, get settled in the society there and get on with their life.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's essentially all they want to do, right? They want to get on with their lives. They're not here to steal our jobs or steal, you know, our opportunities and things like that. I just want to bring up the model, because you did speak to people in Sabah, right? And they've actually got and this was even back then, they already had a system where the government recognized these informal schools, right? Quote unquote informal schools. Tell me about that. You know, basically the children were allowed to study and the government recognized them as well, right?
I'm not sure about the recognition, but okay. There was support from the government. Support in the sense that, you know, they don't disturb them or they allowed them to continue with the work. And I think that's kind of the partnership that we have now. So the government is supporting effort for communities to have schools run by NGOs or run by the community members themselves.
Yeah, because
it's just that what they need, depending on the schools, might be financial assistance. And there is, because they're not part of a formal education system, so, you know, they have different varying degrees of qualifications or, you know, curriculum. So that remains a problem because you have them going to school. Yeah, they are literate, but what is next? So there's no real qualification. Although there's an effort to change that, there are a few secondary schools and these community schools are encouraged to use the local curriculum so that at least they can sit for the SPM exam or sit for some sort of exam. And I think in the last 2 years, there have been partnerships with local private universities to allow refugee children to get a tertiary education.
Okay. Yeah. So, that's some progress. I mean, and that's great to hear as well. But, you know, I'm just watching your film, which was made in 2006, and just reading about what's happening now as well. I mean, we've made some progress, but we still haven't come as far as we should have, I feel. Anyway, I don't know what your thoughts on that are.
We definitely haven't, because according to UNHCR, only 30% of children, refugee children, are getting education.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the pandemic, obviously the schools have had to shut down. Just looking at our own children, you know, having difficulties in getting an education, can you imagine the refugee children who, you know, lack facilities at home,
gadgets.
Gadgets. It's very difficult for them. I haven't found the, like, you know, how many percent in Malaysia, but I think they said 50% of refugee children in the world have had their education interrupted by COVID-19.
Yeah, and that's just education, right? We don't know about the psychosocial impact. We don't know about all the other.
If we have rising domestic violence, rising sexual violence at home, can you imagine, you know, what's happening there? Because right now they just too scared to let anyone in or to go out.
And if they're not documented also, as we know, there's a crackdown on them as well, despite the fact that there is an as a pandemic going on, but so many issues. When the film came out back in 2006, you know, were there any responses or you know, feedback that you got that particularly stood out for you?
I think there were some who were surprised that there are refugee communities living around us, you know, within a larger society. So, and many, I think there were also, I would say many, like, you know, they were not aware that, the children do not have access to schooling.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is, I really thought that in the last 15 years, we've made some progress in changing people's mindset. I think that there has been more acceptance, but last year was really an eye opener.
Oh, yeah.
The COVID-19 incident. Yeah. And you suddenly see the resentment and the hatred.
Yeah. Not even trying to hide it, right? So
yes, yeah. I even have my colleagues who did reports on the plight of refugees during COVID-19 got a lot of hate mail, even from his family members, you know, criticizing him for focusing on them. So, it was really bad, lah.
Just brought out the worst in us, unfortunately. But the film is going to be screened this weekend. I mean, what are your hopes for anybody who's watching it? You know, what do you hope they will take away from the film?
Yeah, I hope they can see that refugees are just like us. You know, they have, apart from the things that they are lacking in their life, their struggles, but you know, they have the same dreams, they have the same desires. They're just like normal people. Mm. You know, we shouldn't make them a bogeyman for our problems. We need to also see where they're coming from. You know, in the film, I also interviewed a Chinese girl, right? So that was in 2006. That was just after their peace process. So they were really thinking about going home because it was suddenly, you know, there was a possibility.
Yeah.
And actually, given a choice, that's what most of, if not all, of the refugees want to do. They want to go home. So we shouldn't be scared about, you know, them wanting to, like you say, take our jobs, steal our jobs,
take our education
and live forever. Yeah, take our education.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, just watch the film. It's only about 20, 21 minutes, but really impactful work. And you know, even though it's 15 years old, it's still as relevant today as it was back then. And again, it's going to be screened this weekend under the Weekend Watch with the Freedom Film Fest. Just head to the Freedom Film Fest's YouTube channel and search for The Invisible Children. Thank you so much, Hari, for joining me today and for sharing about all of this.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. I've been speaking to Hari Azizan. She's the director of The Invisible Children, which takes a look at the status of refugee children in Malaysia and how they lack access to just basic education, you know, something all of us here, you know, all of us Malaysians take for granted, and they're desperate for it. But, you know, because of the rules, they are not allowed to. So have a watch. It's only about 20 minutes. Just search for the YouTube channel for the Freedom Film Fest. And if you miss any part of today's interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, just search for the podcast on the BFM app or at bfm.my/learn. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Kita sangat mengharapkan kalau kerajaan Malaysia itu maulah membantu bagi kita refugee untuk boleh buat pendidikan di sini kan, boleh sambung pendidikan.
Sebagian dia memang tak sanggup fikir daripada anaknya tak ada sekolah kan, lebih baik dia balik kampung dekat sana walaupun menegangkan, cemaskan hati mereka, namun anak-anak mesti sekolah. Itulah.
Kita di sini pelarian bukan pelarian ekonomi. Semua orang dah tahu Aceh itu konflik dari sejak tahun-tahun kemarin-kemarin itu kan. Yang bayi umur 10 hari pun dibakar hidup-hidup. Tidak buat ayam bakar lah. Pasal ayahnya tak dapat. Jadi kita tak berani balik kampung.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.